Why is it so difficult to know what is going on in our brain, even really our brain?
Yes, well, the brain evolved to function, not to reveal its secrets. That's really the answer. And the brain, what's the main job of the brain? That's not to make us smart or happy or creative. It's to keep us alive. It's a survival machine, and it has not changed in any major way during the last 10,000 years. And that means that we have in our heads an organ which creates our experience of existing. And that organ has evolved as a survival machine on the savannah. And that means that we humans are driven by instincts that helped us survive in our evolutionary past. But those instincts don't necessarily make us happy in a world of overabundance. And I think all my books has been an attempt to explain that, how we really function under the hood, because this is the first time in history that we can look inside and see what's happening in our brains. And I think that's incredibly fascinating, but not just fascinating in the sense that a certain area in the brain lights up when you, for instance, scroll on the internet, or when you go for a run or hang out with your friends. But the most important thing here is why the brain functions the way it does. That's the really fascinating part. And a lot of that can be explained by evolution. And I think if we learn that, how we function under the hood, then we can make smarter decisions. So in a way, this knowledge about the brain is a way to become freer from the brain and freer from the restraints that biology has put on us.
You've talked about new possibilities. I would like to ask you about the new technologies which give us some insight to know what's going on in the brain, for example, functional MRI. Do you think that those images are really important, which light in different places? Or do you think that just taking everything together may give us any picture of what's going on?
Well, I think they can be important. One quite concrete example is the dopamine system. The dopamine system tells us to want things. It works as an engine that makes us want food. It makes us want to hang out with our friends, want to have sex, and so on. And the dopamine system is endlessly active. That's why we can never get enough. We evolved not to ever be satisfied other than very short periods, because for our ancestors, it was never possible to get enough. You always had to constantly strive for more food, more security, and so on. Now, the dopamine system does not give us feelings of pleasure, actually. That comes from the endorphin system. And the endorphin system is much more fragile. It goes on, it's more difficult to activate it, and it's much more short-term. And that it's the explanation why it's so easy for the brain to want things, dopamine, but so hard for the brain to be satisfied, endorphins. And the fact that there is a difference between those two explains so much of human nature, I think, and actually so much of our societies. So in that sense, it can be important to see that there is a difference between the two of them. And that result comes also from MRI studies, as you say, that you see that different parts of the brain activate when we want and when we take pleasure. However, it doesn't really, it's not so important exactly what part of the brain. That's more for biology geeks, I think. So some of this knowledge is really valuable. But my big fascination has always been the fact that to us understand why the brain functions the way it does. Why are our wishes endless? Well, that's probably because our ancestors could never get enough. And so once you learn that about yourself, you it's possible to make smarter decisions.
Do you think that the primal instincts which are present in our brain are still so important that it's not changing, or the change in the brain is very hard to be done and would take a much longer time that we evolved in let's say last centuries of the our history, which is very, very speedy, I would say.
Well, evolution is very slow. It takes tens of thousands and normally hundreds of thousands of years before any major changes occur with a species. And the same goes for us humans. The brain and the body has not changed in any major way during the last 10,000 years. Of course, we are also adaptable. The brain is also plastic. It changes depending on what you do with it. So it's not entirely static, but we have in us, in our heads, instincts that are very, very deep. And one of them is that we can't get enough. Another one is that we divide the world into us's and them's. And that is, we can't get rid of that. And as soon, and we instinctively think that us, whether us, it's our team, our nation, our city, is better and more trustworthy than them, so to speak. And us and them can be triggered by basically anything. And I don't think we can ever get rid of that, but we can learn about how that functions in order to make smarter decisions. So that when I see a person from another team or another country or another culture, my initial instinct can be, I don't like that person. He or she is not trustworthy. That's okay if the instinct is that, but I don't have to follow that instinct. I could think, it's just my brain playing tricks on me because this is how we're wired. So that's why it's so important to learn about how you function under the hood.
One may say that the present times are easier for our bodies, but maybe tougher for our brains. It's easier to just make a living, but we are under constant pressure and our brain has to develop some strategies to not to cave in under this pressure.
Yes, absolutely. And we live in a world which is safer than ever in human history. And we are also wealthier than we have ever been and healthier. And still many people suffer from mental health problems. And why is that? Well, I think part of the explanation is that we have forgotten that we are biological beings. We have forgotten what it is that makes us happy in the end, and that what makes us feel good. And what's that? Well, that's sleep and exercise, and most importantly, other humans, meeting real life face to face. Those are the things that protect us against depressions and anxiety. However, we are also driven by these instincts that help us survive. And survival is always more important than well-being for the brain. And those instincts have been hacked in modern society by tech companies, for instance, that makes us endlessly scroll on our social media. And also when we are exposed to the news, all wars and disasters that we read about, the brain thinks that that is occurs in our surroundings, because everything that humans heard about or was happened in their surroundings. And even though you don't know, even though that you know on an intellectual level that the war in Iran doesn't really affect your security, the brain has a very hard time distinguishing between that. So that is probably the reason why we live in a world which is safer than ever, but we walk around and think that the world is very dangerous. And I'm not saying that you should sort of hide from all news. You should keep reading and keeping informed, but you should perhaps be aware of the fact that the brain has difficulty distinguishing what's personal and what's not. So a good idea is to read the news in the morning and the evening if you have problems with any stress and anxiety, and skip it for the rest of the day. So modern society is, as you say, putting new kinds of pressure on the brain, and the problems that it has to deal with historically, danger and scarcity, is now followed by overabundance and safety. And the brain is not really so good equipped at dealing with that. And that's why we need to be aware of it. And you could, of course, say, well, perhaps we will evolve. Eventually, humans will evolve and the brain will be perfectly adapted to this modern world. And if you think about it, what would have to occur for that to happen? Well, the one, for instance, if humans were to develop an ability to understand computer code instinctively, that would be a good thing, right, in our modern world. What would need to happen for that to occur? Well, the ones of us who don't have that ability would have to die, or at least don't have any kids. And I don't have any ability to, I can't read computer code, and I don't want to die. So evolution has basically stopped. That's what healthcare is all about. And that's a wonderful thing. I mean, with IVF, we give parents who don't become parents, who don't become parents naturally, we help assist them with that. But thereby, genes that affects your ability to have kids are brought to the next generation. And that's a wonderful thing. That's a wonderful thing. But that's basically means that evolution has stopped.
So we are who we are, and we have to live with it, and
Yes,
we
exactly.
have to deal with our problems with all we have, but we probably wouldn't have any additional abilities, maybe additional knowledge, but not abilities.
Exactly. I think that's exactly the case. And we are surrounded with this incredibly powerful technology now with AI, and the world is changing at an incredibly fast pace. And we will not change. We will still be the same. And if we want to get the best out of this technology, we don't just have to learn about the technology. We also need to understand ourselves and understand our Achilles heels.
You are writing books for adults, about adults, and for young people, for kids, and about kids. And please let me ask you about the differences, because younger generation is living in the social media reality from the very beginning, and we are living in this in the second part of our life. As a psychiatrist, can you see the differences in which about our way of dealing with it? Is it now psychiatry for young people and older people completely different?
Well, there's always been a division between child psychiatry and adult psychiatry, but children today are exposed to pressures on social media that previous generations have not been. And as you're probably aware, depressions and anxiety is a rising problem for children and teenagers all over the world, actually. So what I've done is that I have made the children's or teenage versions of my books together with an author who specialized in that. And we've let the schools in Sweden order these books for the cost of sending them on the mail. And I think 350,000 books have been ordered now, and they're used in half of all Swedish schools. And kids come up to me on the street every day and they say, "Now I understand my brain and myself a little bit better. I understand why it's a good thing to do some sport, to keep the phone outside the bedroom. Not to scroll endlessly and so on and so forth. There is power in this knowledge also for children and teenagers, and they are exactly as interested in their brains as we are as adults.
But some may say that there are different kind of message. From one side, we tell in schools not to judge, not to make a comparison between different pupils, not to stress them too much. And in the social media life, they have hate, bullying, and frustration. So if we are too kind for them as a parents who cannot be too tough, we cannot give them any knowledge how to deal with it,
Yeah, that's a
because
great
they are
question.
not criticized and then criticized by all the world. What do you think
Yeah,
about it?
that's a great point. And of course, I think maybe children and teenagers have been overprotected in the real world, but they have definitely been underprotected in the digital world. I mean, just imagine if I would say something nasty to you, or anyone else, people in my surroundings will tell me, "What are you doing? Well, you're a jerk," right? So there's always been consequences in behaving like an asshole. But today you can hide behind the screen and you can tell things that without any consequences, and you don't just say that to the person. You say that in front of hundreds or thousands of people. So the amount of stress and comparison that you are exposed to today as a teenager is so toxic and so different from the thing that you and I grew up with. So yes, perhaps we should not be as perhaps they should get exposed to more danger and stress in the real life, but they sh one should also regulate these technologies. And by that, I mean social media. And as you are probably aware, there are many court cases where people have sued Meta, for instance, for mental health problems for teenagers for getting exposed to all this. And I think in the future we will see it as a shame that we did not regulate these incredible, powerful technologies, especially directed to kids and teenagers. They were just let loose without any regulation.
Very important message of your books is that one cannot be happy all the time. One probably may be happy sometimes. How can we learn not to be happy and live with it if the social media show us happy people in beautiful places, in beautiful shape, with everything they want? Our young people, and not only young, can learn back the knowledge that the life is hard and mostly not very happy at all.
Right. I mean, the brain never evolved to keep us happy. It evolved to keep, to make sure that to keep us alive. So any positive feelings should be short term, and they should soon go up in smoke and be replaced by new cravings. That's just how we're wired. And why? Well, that's because that's how our ancestors survived. So when we, as you say, when we expect to feel good all the time, we are setting a goal that is completely unrealistic. We never evolved that. But we are led to believe that's a possibility and on advertisements and social media. And therefore we compare ourselves to something that is completely unrealistic. And one way to deal with it is by doing what you and I are doing now, to talk about it, learn about this. And you don't just learn about it one time. You have to re learn about it many times. You have to hear it in slightly different ways. And then eventually you will see it in others. And then finally you will see it in yourself. And have more realistic expectations on your mental life. And you will realize that it's okay to have a period of feeling anxious and stressed and perhaps a bit depressed. If it's really damaging to your life, you should seek help, of course. But for short-term periods, it doesn't mean that you are damaged or sick or anything like that. It means that you are functioning normally.
Do you think that we have some kind of psychiatric pandemic in the world, especially concerning young people? More and more of them feel depressed, feel sad, and need help.
Yeah, that's a very, very difficult question to answer, actually, because there's no way to measure these things. You ask people questions, you often feel bad, you often have anxiety, and the way you respond to such questions can depend on the time period that you live in. To be anxious could be one thing today and a completely different thing in the 80s because one did not talk about these things. There are some signs that mental health is actually decreasing among young people, and that is that self-harm is increasing. And self-harm is, I mean, you can't, th these are actual wounds that are being treated in hospital, and more young people are being admitted to hospital wards for self-harm. So there are some signs that we may that may be a mental health decrease among teenagers. But I mean, I think the big question is not, has it decreased? The big question is, why hasn't it increased? We have become, you know, the size of the economy has doubled in Sweden at least since the 90s. We have become twice as rich, but we are definitely not twice as happy. And if you ask, well, why should you mix money with happiness? Well, you could ask any CEO of a company, why should we have economic development? And they will say, well, so that we should have it better, of course. And if you then naively ask, why should we have it better? Well, they will answer, so that we should feel better, of course. And we obviously don't do that. So that's why we need this knowledge, I think, about the brain and how we function and about well-being, because in the end, that it is what matters most to almost everyone.
Let me ask you about the Scandinavian way of life. We in the Central Europe, we of course have our winters, but of course in Scandinavia, winters are longer. Sun is scarce and the days are shorter, and we know that there is difficult to live in the north. And of course, we listen about the way of living of Danes, hygge or something like that, the way of feeling happy for longer times. Then, can you see the difference between northern people and I'm not talking about southerners. They are lucky; they have sun all the year and they can just sleep outside all the year, but. Can you see the difference? Are you different?
That's a great, great question. I'm not sure I dare to answer that. Finns seems to be very happy according to these happiness indexes. However, you must be cautious when you interpret that because it's also how you translate words. Are you happy? What does that mean? What does the word happy mean? It might be one thing in Finland and another one in Scandinavia, and certainly another one in southern Italy. So it's actually difficult to compare this, but Scandinavian countries are relatively happy, at least. But compared to Central Europe, I don't dare to draw any such conclusions, but I can certainly attest to the fact that winters are long and hard in Scandinavia. We had a horrible winter this year. It's way too long and way too cold.
So it's nice that we are talking just in the beginning of spring. Let me ask you about your take about how to help people feel better. Medicine, psychiatry, artificial intelligence and chatbots. What do you think? What will happen? All the ways of seeking help will be smarter and smarter.
Yeah. Well, antidepressant medication is effective when it comes to severe depressions. It has helped reducing the suicide rates, but in Sweden, 1 in 8 adults are on antidepressant medication, and I think that is perhaps too much. Maybe we have focused too little on the alternatives. I think often psychotherapy is more effective, but psychotherapy, that takes time and it needs a therapist, and you don't have an infinite amount of those. Can AI replace that? Well, maybe to some degree, but you should be a bit cautious when you use AI for mental health because it isn't developed for that. And often it gives good advice, but sometimes it can give terrible advice, things that no therapist or actually no adult would ever say. So perhaps it can be alleviate some of these problems, but most importantly, I think we need to talk about it more and take the stigma away. And have a discussion about mental health and realize that it's not as simple as saying pull yourself up or be happy or something like that. You would never dream of saying to a diabetic, pull up your blood sugar. It doesn't work like that. So you can't say to someone who is depressed, pull yourself up. That's absurd. So it's good that people are starting to talk more about these things. That discussion must be balanced against the fact that you could medicalize perfectly normal feelings. So any short period of stress or anxiety should not be treated. You should not seek help for that. You should seek help if it's a long period and you really suffer and it really has negative consequences on your life. So there is a balance to be struck there when it comes to taking away the stigma and medicalizing. So far, I think this discussion about mental health is doing more good than harm, I must say.
You are writing about one way of feeling better and one universal medicine for our brain. It's physical exercise. And I would like to ask you a little bit more about that. We know that we should move as much as possible, but what can we do in the normal life to give our brain more chances to feel good thanks to physical exercise.
Yes, so physical activity is of course incredibly important for the body, but it's also important for the brain and all of our cognitive functions, ability to focus, creativity, memory. Everything is boosted if you're physically active, and you also feel better and reduce stress. And actually, physical activity is as effective as antidepressant medication for mild and moderate depressions. So to be physically active is very important for the brain. However, we are also lazy. And why is that? Well, that's because the brain's goal is not to make us happy, it's to survive. And for almost all previous generations of humans, it was important not to waste your calories, not to waste your energy unless you really had to. So that's why we want to stay in the couch, even though exercise is so incredibly good for us. So what should we do then? Well, I think first of all, you should learn about the effects of exercise on the brain, and you should also learn why you are lazy. And then you could build your way around that. And that could mean walking to work or riding your bike to school or getting used to walking in stairs instead of taking the elevator. Find the small stuff that you do without thinking too much about it, because you don't want to negotiate with the lazy part of yourself, because that part is a very good negotiator. So I think, and you should not mix physical activity with sports. Physical activity has nothing to do with being one in the soccer team or one in the marathon club. It's something that we as a species have evolved for. So my advice to everyone is learn more about the brain and how it's affected by physical activity. And then these, you know, to build it into your life will come almost automatically when you understand why it's so important and why you also want to avoid it at the same time.
Thank you very much.
Nice talking to you.
Have a great day.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.